Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, The Road to Creativity, part of the Podmatch Podcast Network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. One of the things that is a constant in storytelling that we hear a lot from different critics is that all the stories have already been told. Wrong, because your story has not been told. And what we need is a little something that my guest's editor actually coined perfectly, which is history at eye level. And that is exactly what we have here for as our guest today. Jim Paulk is a graduate from the Naval Academy class of 57, and he has gone on to write so far now three books, two of them that are already out there, one of them that's in the process of being put together. The first one is Swimming for Our Lives. Another one is Shaking Up the World. And he's going to be talking in great detail about his upcoming third one. And I am just really excited to get this sort of insight from someone who has been through so much in terms of all the different amazing situations that he and his wife have been in, that they have found themselves in and out of, the constant adventurous nature that they both share, what has come as a result of that. So this is, Jim's got some amazing tales to tell. And based on our early conversation, I have a feeling this won't be the last we hear from him. So it's my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Jim Paulk. Jim, how are you, sir?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm doing great. And I want to tell you that tomorrow is my birthday and I'll be
92 years old. Now, when you guys hear this, you're going to be hearing this in December. So we'll say for the record, December 1st is Jim's birthday. So happy birthday as I'm saying it right now, happy birthday in advance. But I know that when other people hear it, it'll be happy belated birthday. But I am very excited for you as well.
Thank you very much.
So before we dive into the two books that are out there right now, I'm really interested to hear what the third book that's in preparation for is going to be about.
The third one is titled How I Found You. And it's a story of love and relationships. And I decided that the most important thing in life is really love and relationships. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explore that. And I wanted to get stories that I could share with people to maybe inspire them. And some of the stories do exactly that. The first story in the book is about a man that had been single for a long time and tried different relationships. It hadn't worked. Nothing had worked. He had tried all the dating things and they didn't work. And he had practically given up. But his mother had fallen and broken her hip and was in a rehabilitation center. But her recovery was not going well. But he went to visit her every day. Mm-hmm. And while he was there, he noticed some days there was a woman that walked down the hall. He could always hear her because she was moving fast as lightning. He decided that she must be on a mission because she moved so fast. And over a period of time, he looked at this woman, but he couldn't get up enough courage to go and talk to her and ask about her. But they had said hello a couple of times, and the cafeteria was right across the hall from his mother's room, and she would go in there, and he knew it. She wouldn't be in there more than about 3 minutes, and she was out. And he tried to catch her a couple of times, but he backed off. But one day, she came into the room and said, talk to his mother. She was not her patient, but she said, ask her mother how she was doing. And that was the beginning of their relationship. And it's worked out beautifully. And both of them are in their 50s, and neither expected to find anybody. They thought the way life was going to be was this. And now they are so happy. And he called her the mystery woman. In the book, I called her the beautiful mystery woman.
Nice.
But it is a fascinating story, and there are just all the stories here are so different. And there's another story where these two women had dates, and they're in the restaurant, and they're having a drink, and things aren't going well. So one of them asked the other one, how about going to the powder room with me? So instead of going to the powder room, they went out the door, and they told the waiters that went out the door, tell those two guys over there their dates are gone. And they went somewhere else and met friends, and the one gal met someone as a result of ditching those guys. I just think it's so fascinating. These things couldn't be happening, but they do. And they're just exciting stories. But I think the book will do well. I think with all books, people have to know about it. And I don't know how many people will know about it. But right now, I'm getting birthday wishes already. And people are saying, I knew a lot of people in your first book. And others are saying, keep writing. And one said, you're an inspiration to all of us. And I'm thinking, I'm not even an inspiration to myself. I still can't perceive myself as writing books. I don't know. I was always such a poor writer in school, lousy. And I'll tell you a story about that. George Perry holds the world's record for a largemouth bass, all tackle record. And he caught it in 1932. Okay. And I said, no way that could have been the George Perry I knew when I was a little boy. So I called my best friend from school, lived in South Carolina. I said, Mike, is this George Perry they're talking about world record? Is that the George Perry we knew? He said, yes, it was. I said, you know what? I have got to do a story on him. He is the most unusual character I ever met in my life. He was so different. I said, people need to know him. They need to know him other than just the name in the record book and the 22 pounds, 4 ounce bass that he caught, which is still a record today. And so I did about 9 months of research. Some stories were mine that I experienced with him and not others. And I got all this and I decided I wasn't competent enough to write that story. It was too important with me with poor writing skills. So I called Pete Thomas, who was the outdoor editor of the LA Times and maybe the best in the country. I said, Pete, how about I give you all these notes and you write this story on George Perry? And he said, Jimmy, he said, I've read some of your stuff and you get better. I said, well, that ain't much. Nice. He said, you do it. And I said, okay. So I put all these notes on the table and I started writing it and I handed it to my wife. I said, Pat, what do you think? She read it and she said, it's awful. I laughed. I said, I know it's awful, but we can work on it. But that was the genesis of getting writing. A friend of mine that was outdoor editor for the Augusta Chronicles actually did a book on George Perry and named it Remembering George Perry, the same as my article. And he's the one that encouraged me to do a book. And I said, no way. He said, just take some of your magazine articles and put them together. And that's a book. And I said, I'll do some research. And I looked through my files and most of them were just one step above garbage. They were terrible. Mm. And I said, maybe 4 or 5 I could make into a worthy of a book. But anyway, that's how Swimming for Our Lives came about. That my friend encouraged me to do it, and I told him he tricked me into doing a book. And then after that one, everybody wanted me to do another book. And then I said, my classmates in the Naval Academy, the most remarkable people in the world. And that's why I call that book Shaking Up the World, because they literally did that. Brad Parkinson, who was the architect of the GPS system. That's worldwide and monumental.
Oh, my.
It's like discovering electricity. It's unbelievable what he did. And
huge contribution,
It's gigantic. And that story was a critical failure that led to GPS because he had put together some engineers in the Pentagon. They had developed the system, and he made a presentation in the Pentagon to all the generals and the admirals, and all he wanted, give me some money so I can put some satellites up so that we can develop this system and see if it's going to work. They said, no, no money. But there was a contractor in the room. And after the session, He was a little downhearted, and the contractor says, I think you've got something, and I think we can work on it and put it together. And that was the beginning. And, of course, he received all kind of awards. And there's a photo in the book of him receiving the Queen Elizabeth II Award for engineering from Prince Charles.
Yeah.
And in the picture, they both got this really grin on their face. And so I said, Brad, I said, what's with this big grin on your face from Prince Charles? He said, the prince asked me if I could explain to him how GPS works. And I said, have you got about an hour? Brad's a super guy. And there's another story of some work that he did where he was teaching at Air Force Academy, and he was associate department head for Department of Aeronautics. They wanted to pull him out to go and develop a digital system for aiming the 40-millimeter guns in the gunships over Laos. Oh, and wow. He says, I'm teaching classes. I can't do that. He says, we've already arranged for you. You are the only man in the Air Force that can do this. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't done, they're going to scrap the program, and you are our only hope to get it fixed.
Wow, no pressure or anything.
This guy is absolutely an engineering genius, and now he's retired professor emeritus from Stanford University. He taught advanced mathematics there after he got out of the Air Force. But that's an unbelievable story.
Yeah.
Another story, Charlie Duke. And if you remember the movie Apollo 13.
Oh, yeah.
In the beginning of the movie, they said, you can't go because Charlie had the measles. Charlie Duke had the measles, mm-hmm. and you've been exposed, and we can't put you in space.
Yep.
So anyway, Charlie and that astronaut went on Apollo 16. And it's described in the book of their 3 days on the moon. They had a rover. They rode around. They could only go 4 miles away from the lander because that way, if it broke down, 4 miles is the furthest they could walk with that big, heavy, wet backpack on. Mm-hmm. And so it never did break down. And one drove and one narrated. Charlie was on the phone all the time. He narrated with NASA what he was seeing and describing and whatever. And then the Olympics were going on at the same time they were on the moon. And they decided that maybe they should have an Olympics on the moon. And before they could discuss it, Charlie started bouncing and something. I'm doing a long jump. And then when he was in the air, he realized if I land on my back, I'm dead because his backpack will break. And he said, mm-hmm. I'll be dead.
Yeah.
But I twisted my body, so I landed on my side. And then his companion there said, Charlie, that was not a very good idea.
Yeah.
And about that time, NASA got on the phone and said, no more. So about 20 years later, they received a certificate from the Olympic Committee recognizing their exposure to the Olympics on the moon. That was fun. But Charlie sent me about 20 photos, and I picked 10 for the book. So there's some great photos of NASA photos on the moon there. And I will just say this. People often ask, was anything unusual about the doing the stories? And I said, this one was different because most people wrote the stories, sent them to me, and I edited them, and we went back and forth. But Charlie said, I want you to interview me, and you write the story. I said, okay, Charlie, I'll do it. So I invited my 30-year-old granddaughter over, and got a photographic memory, and I said, we'll both take a set of notes, and when we get done, I'll take the two sets of notes and I'll write the story. So that's what I did. And I sent it to Charlie and edited it and added a couple of details, and it turned out to be a great story. But to me, that was so much fun because I got to do it with my granddaughter and do it with Charlie. And it was a team effort that was different than the other stories we did. What I did some of the stories were obtained from a disc from many years earlier, and that classmate had passed away. And it was raw data, and it had never been edited, and so it took a lot of work. And some of them were too long. I had to shorten them. When I got done, I always have a committee. I don't have enough confidence in myself, and I always feel like I need others more than they need me. And so I had 8 others to help me. One was a woman that was retired from the Smithsonian that was probably smarter than all of us. And she was a big help. I would send these stories to them and maybe to a couple of them and ask them to check it for accuracy and edit it and send it back. And so we had work. We had a lot of us that were working on these stories and doing it together.
Yeah.
And that's why I call it the class of 1957, Stories from 57, because it's our class book.
Yeah.
And the proceeds from this book are going to the Naval Academy Foundation to sponsor a professor in the history department at the Naval Academy, teach naval heritage. And that's a project that we decided it was our 50th anniversary gift to the Naval Academy was this professor. And we, over a period of years, we raised enough money. And now the proceeds from this book will go to that. And then I'm having the proceeds from my next book will go to it also. Mm-hmm. So I don't, all my books proceeds go to charity. And that way I don't have any guilt feelings about talking about them, whatever, because it's all for a good cause. But Shaking Up the World was a really fun book to do. And we did it over a period of about a year. And like I said, there were a lot of us involved in it. Overall, there are 59 authors in this book.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So it's a really good like anthology of that, of those kinds of perspectives and those kinds of stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's varied stories. There are two stories in here from children. Both, there's a little girl who's 4 years old. Mm-hmm. Her father was a graduate of the academy, but he was a young gunnery officer on a destroyer that's out to sea with Halsey ships that were not in Pearl Harbor when it was attacked.
Oh, wow.
And their house was less than a mile from the harbor when the bombs started coming down. And their next door neighbors came over and put her mother and her little brother in a car and drove to a tunnel to get away from the bombs.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, their neighbors were Japanese.
Oh.
And if you remember what happened after the war, most of the Japanese were put in internment camps. It was a horrible thing, but we thought all Japanese could be spies. And this family was interrogated and was not put in internee camp.
Good to know. That's
really
good to know.
Nice to hear.
Yeah.
The other classmate was 8 years old, and his father was a graduate at West Point and was at the air station there. And their house was two houses from the station for the airport. It was being attacked by the Japanese. He was standing out by the curb waiting for a bus to take him to Sunday school. And the Japanese planes were flying over and strafing the airfield, and the empty cartridges were falling in the street. Oof. And like any 8-year-old boy, what are you going to do? You go walk around, pick those things up, and put them in your pocket. His dad came home and grabbed him and took him into the house and put he and his brother under a table to shield them some. And when the attack died off, some families were evacuated to a school in a pineapple field about 8 miles away until they could be evacuated to the United States. But Tom's story calls it an odyssey because it followed him through his whole life that he was in. He went back to live with his grandparents in Oklahoma during the war. There were several times he was asked to get up on a stage and describe what had happened and tell his experience. And that went off his whole life. And eventually in the Navy, he was stationed at Pearl Harbor. He was in charge of the Naval Shipyard there.
Yeah.
It's an incredible story in all the aspects of his life and how it started off when he was 8 years old. And that's a kind of a fun experience there.
Yeah.
That's now, a church story. My wife and I were very active in our church and went to church on Sundays. And one Sunday, the pastor was into a sermon, and the people in front of us started half rising up out of their seats. And I couldn't figure out what they were doing. And they did it 2 or 3 times. Eventually, I saw there was a possum up there in the front of the church, and he was kind of running in and out underneath. And when he'd come out, the people were rising up to look. The pastor finally saw what's happening, and he said, will the ushers please come down here and get this animal? And everybody turned around and looked up the aisle. They didn't make a move. And the pastor asked again, will you come down here and get this animal? Nobody was going to do it. Pat punched me in the ribs and says, go down here and get that thing. And I'm saying, oh, man. And next thing I know, I'm up on my feet and I'm walking down there. And I had experience with a possum before. And they have sharp teeth and claws and they can tear you up. So oh, yeah. I'm thinking all the time, this thing's going to rip me apart. But I got down there and I motioned a lot with my left hand and I reached down and picked him up. And I started up the aisle with him. Mm-hmm. Of course, all eyes are on me. They don't know whether I'm going to drop him. He's going to be all over somebody or what. But there was not a sound in that church.
Yeah.
So I went out the door and I walked about 15, 20 yards. And then I had a conversation with that possum. Said, I'm going to turn you free. But I don't want you to ever come in this church again. So mm-hmm. I let him go, and I walked in and took my place at the seat. And Pat says, the pastor's been talking about you the whole time you've been gone. I said, really? He said, he's telling everybody that you're an outdoorsman from Georgia, and you got all this background and everything. And he said, you are the best fisherman in Huntington Beach. And I said,
wow. Well,
that's not true, but anyway, I like the possum story.
That's great. That is great. And that's great that he was basically just talking you up while you were taking care of this, because I'm sure that there were a lot of other people that were thinking just, who was that guy? And so he was answering that question. Who's the one that actually stepped up? And the funny thing, whenever that happens, that's when the wife kind of like nudges you in the ribs and just says, go, get up there. Yep, you do.
It's unusual that we had a classmate that was the survivor of Auschwitz, a Nazi death camp. He was a Polish Jew. The family was from Eastern Poland. The Nazis rounded up. His father was actually had a manufacturing clothing business, and they put his mother and his father and he and his little brother on a boxcar and went west to Auschwitz. When they got there, the wind was blowing in that direction, and they could actually smell the burning flesh from the oven. So they knew that they didn't have much of a future. The Nazis divided them up into three groups. They put the men in one group, they put the boys in a group, and they put the women and the girls in another group. And Art Erickson was his name, and Art found out a couple of years later that his mother and his sister had been executed immediately. The Nazis did not want any Jewish women alive because they could bear more Jews, and they had planned to execute every Jew in the world. I think there was something like 6 million Jews that they executed during World War II. Mm-hmm. Art survived the war, and when it was over, he was liberated. His father was liberated, but they weren't together. They hadn't seen one another for all those years. His father went to New York, and he was sent back to his home in Eastern Poland, where a former nanny took care of him. So many Jewish families were separated, and there was an organization that was designed just to put families back together again.
Yeah.
And they put him on a ship, and he went to New York and joined his father. They went to Texas, and somehow he got an appointment to Annapolis, came to the Naval Academy, did well. He spoke five languages brilliantly, and I just think that's... Surviving Auschwitz is an unbelievable story.
Yes.
And it was written by his roommate. He had passed away, but his roommate wrote the story, and I really like that one. Now, there's another story. Right now, we're in the middle of football season and playoffs and everything, and we had a classmate, Bob McElwee, was in the NFL as an official for 27 years. When I announced to my class that I was going to do a book on a class, Bob was one of the first ones to call me. And he said, Jimmy, he said, would you like to have some stories from NFL? I said, oh boy, would I. That would be fabulous. So his stories in here are knee-slapping funny.
And really?
He did three Super Bowls as a white hat, as a referee. And he said, I had a number of things I had to do before the whistle blew and the play was started. He said, I had to check the game clock, the play clock, the formations, the substitutions. and a couple other things. But he said, when I was in Chicago, I had one other thing I had to do. He said, I had to reach around in the back pocket and see if my penalty flag was there. He said, if it was not there, he said, I'd go to the huddle. I'd stand behind number 34 and I'd say, Walter, give me my penalty flag back. And Peyton would pull it out, hold his jersey and hand it to him.
Walter was always very much like that sort of prankster and everything. So the fact that he would do that with the ref absolutely does not surprise me in the slightest. He would always mess with everyone.
Do you remember
Katarina Vick? I think so.
She was an ice skater, an absolutely gorgeous ice skater from East Germany. And anyway, Bob was doing a game in Berlin. In Western Berlin. Before the game started, the officials came to him and said, Katarina Vick is going to toss the coin today, and we'll bring it to you so you walk out, work her out on the field. And Bob said, okay. They brought her to him, and she took him by the arm. She says, Bob, I have something to tell you. He said, what is that? She said, when we walk out on the field, everybody in the stand is going to whistle. And that's the equivalent of booing over here in Europe. And said, they don't like me very much over here. And Bob said, well, don't worry about that much. I've been booed in every stadium in the United States.
That's right. When you're an official, it's free reign right there. It's like you're going to wind up upsetting someone every single week.
But anyway, he's got several stories in there that are fun. I'll tell you my favorite story in the book. George Phillips was the skipper of an ocean-going tugboat, which is unusual for an academy graduate. But it's got all petty officers on there, which are highly trained because it's very hazardous work with fuel lines and barges and ropes and everything. And he had two chief warrant officers, and one for the engineering spaces and one topside. And the one topside was Bosun Bean. And they get an assignment to go to Philadelphia to the reserve fleet and pick up a destroyer there and tow it around Florida to Texas. So they got up there, got it hooked up, and got it out into the Atlantic, and it was kind of rough out there. And they learned that there was a big storm brewing down off of Florida. And they said, no way we could get out there in the storm with this big destroyer behind us. It would be very hazardous. He said, so we're going to pull in to Port Angeles and wait out the storm. Now, Port Angeles is now called Fort Lauderdale. So the night before they got in, George started having extreme abdominal pains. His hospital corpsman, the doctor on board, said, sir, you have an appendicitis. When we get in, you have to go directly to the hospital. So when they got in, got tied up and all secure, the ambulance and the paramedics were up on the dock. They came down, loaded George up on a gurney, and there goes a skipper on a gurney on the way to the hospital. They determined that wasn't appendicitis, it was gastroenteritis, and they treated him, and the next morning they let him go. So he gets back to the boat, and everybody's standing there waiting for him. Sir, nobody has any money. We haven't been paid in 2 weeks. Here we are in the best Liberty port in the United States, right here near Miami. We can't go ashore and have a good time because we have no money. But we found out if you take our pay records down to the Coast Guard station in Miami, they will give you cash. You can come back and pay us. We can all go ashore and have a wonderful time. And, sir, we have a pickup truck for you. Sailors always have everything figured out. George gets in the pickup truck and heads down Highway A1A. And A1A has ocean on one side and strip malls on the other.
Yep.
And at some point, a car pulls out of the strip center without looking. And George swerved to the left and scraped all the way down the side of another car. They pull off the road, and the other driver called the police. The police came and gave George a ticket. And they said, we're taking your driver's license because you're in the Navy. We can't depend on you showing up in court. But yeah. You come to court at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and we'll give you your license back. So George goes to court. He gets there, and eventually, and the judge is really an ornery, tough customer. He speaks Spanish well because half the cases are Hispanic, of course, in Miami. And eventually the clerk calls his name, and George stands up, and the clerk reads the charges. And the judge looked at him and said, "How do you plead?" George said, "Not guilty." And the judge says, $25. And George said, "Let me explain." The judge said, $25. And George said, "Sir." And the judge says, "Bailiff, take him away." So the bailiff takes George by the arm and locks him up. So there's a phone on the wall, and George didn't have $25. He had some change, and there was a payphone. Mm-hmm. So he called a boat, and he got his executive officer, who was the Lieutenant JG, and he said, "I need you to come down here with $25 and bail me out. They got me locked up in jail down here in Miami." And the executive officer said, "Sir, I don't have $25.
Oh,
he said, "Well, pass the damn hat. There's got to be $25 on the boat." So a couple hours later, they showed up, and the bailiff let them out in the hall. And he's looking there, and he's boasting Bean. He said, "Why are you here? You're all dressed up in blues. You look like you're ready for inspection." He said, "Sir," he said, "I've never been had to bail out this captain before, and I wasn't going to miss this." And about that time, the judge came out of the courtroom, and he saw them standing in the hall. And he and Boston Bean start looking at each other. And all of a sudden, they run together, grabbing and jumping up and down and everything. It turned out that they had grown up and were best friends together and had enlisted in the Navy, and they were on a battleship in Pearl Harbor, and wow. A bomb blew both of them over the sides, and each had thought the other was dead for 24 years. So they paid the $5 and went back to the boat. So he gets in his cabin, he gets on the phone, he calls his wife. "Honey, I have something to tell you. Sit down." He said, "In the last 2 days, I've been in and out of the hospital and in and out of jail, and that's all I have to say."
Wow. That is amazing. 24 years, and neither one of them knew that the other one was still alive. That is so wild. That is so wild. So these stories, they're all in Shaking Up the World.
Yes.
So if this isn't the best possible commercial for getting your hands on this book, then I don't know what will. So it's available on paperback and ebook currently.
It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, of course, and there's also an audiobook. I have audio.
Oh, there is an audiobook. Good.
Yeah, audiobooks. And if you'd like a copy of audiobook, send me your email address, and I'll have my assistant send you you can get a free audio if you want to do it.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
If you got time for another story.
Sure, I got time for another one.
Okay, the story that I think, there are several stories in this book that would make a great movie, but yeah. The one that I think has got the most action and diversity in it is amazing. It's about a classmate by the name of Walt Mukau. He was born in 1933 in Shanghai, China. His father was retired from the Navy as a chief quartermaster and worked at the embassy there. And if you remember before we were involved in the war, the Japanese invaded northern China, were moving south. And when the bombs started coming down in Shanghai, the chief decided he better get his family out of there. So they got on a ship and they went to the Philippines. And of course, you know what happened when they got to the Philippines. The Japanese were shortly there. But they were given a house to live in, and they were told that if the sirens go off for air raid, then you would go down the street. There's a fort down there. That's your air raid shelter. So when the sirens went off, they ran down the street into the shelter. And when they got back, the house where they had been living had a direct hit, and they had nothing left, nothing, not even a change of clothes. It was all gone.
Wow.
And when the chief went to his place of work, it had direct hit, and all the people there had been killed.
Oof.
If he had been there, he would have been gone. They experienced a Bataan death march where the army surrendered 10,000 troops, mm-hmm. and they marched them, and a lot of them died and were tortured and whatever. And they had some provisions, and they shared with the troops. And then they were told they were to surrender. And so they went to the place of surrender to the Japanese. And the father, of course, was interrogated because they thought he was a spy.
Yeah.
But eventually he was released, and they were put into an internee camp, which is the word for is civilian prisoner of war camp. And over the period of the war, they were moved from one camp to another. And at each camp, there was less food.
Yeah.
And Walt and his younger brother at times would go under the fence and go out the jungle and try and get fruit for the family to eat. Mm-hmm. If they had been caught, they would have been executed. But they managed to survive. Near the end of the war, the U.S. Army heard a rumor that the Japanese planned to execute all of the prisoners in that internee camp because they didn't have food for them, so they're just going to kill them. So the Army put together a raid. Working with the Philippine guerrillas, they parachuted in, and they killed the 75 guards of the internee camp. They put the prisoners in Amtraks, which they had brought over from the sea, across the sea, on the land, loaded everybody up, went back across the water to behind U.S. lines, and they were all rescued. Mm-hmm. And there were no injuries. One guy sprained his ankle and has landed in a parachute, but that was it. Mm-hmm. And Walt at that time was 13 years old and weighed 52 pounds. He said when he got back, he said, I just stuffed myself. I could never get enough to eat. To me, that story is so full of exciting details and drama and everything. It would make a great movie. And I don't know whether Walt would even allow it to be made into a movie, but I've always thought that would be a great movie. But it's a fun story.
There are a lot of different stories, I think, even just the ones you talked about today, and I'm sure that so many of the other ones that are in there would make a very interesting kind of anthology film that would weave characters in and out of the focus. I think that would be really fascinating. The types of stories that are here are not only uplifting, they're humorous, they're educational, and they're the types of stories that I believe we need now more than ever to kind of get a reminder that humanity can be better than what we have been.
Well, I had one classmate that is from Rockport, Massachusetts, and a good friend. And we were talking. He said, Jimmy, we're all either dead or dying. I said, yeah, that's probably true at our age. But I think the stories in this book are so diverse. There's one that's a fish farm in the Philippines. There's another that's publishing a newspaper on Molokai and Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. All these different things. And if you're a youngster and you're looking up and you don't know where life is going to take you. It's evolutionary. Mm-hmm. And we all go in directions that we never conceived of. I find that we're told that this book is very inspirational because you can look at us. We started out with 1,160 at the end of June in 1953. And we graduated 848.
Wow.
And now there are about 250 of us that are still alive. When you look at all of these different things and different experiences that you would never have imagined when we first got there that first night, I will tell you, when I got there, I was in awe of my classmates. The first night, we had no responsibilities. We weren't sworn in until the next day. Everybody's running around, where are you from, what do you do, and it seemed like to me that everyone I met had graduated valedictorian of the class, were president of the class, and captain of the football team. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, George, I was none of those things. What in the world am I doing here?
Yeah.
I'm a pretty average guy. And now, almost 70 years later, I'm still in awe of my classmates. I'm more so because now I can look back and say, wow, these guys are amazing. Look what they all did.
Yep.
And I can tell you that the book that I put together is the first book of its nature in the history of the Naval Academy since 1845. Mm-hmm. And the reason, because of the diversity of stories by different authors. I think there have been a lot of movies made about Annapolis and then books written about hundreds of books about the Naval Academy. But ours is different because it's 59 separate authors and all the different stories. It's not about me. It's about others. And it was such an honor for me. And I think, what did I get out of it? I think relationships with my classmates. I just love my classmates. I've got to know people I didn't know before. And to me, that was the benefit that I got out of it.
That's great. And so we can definitely get our hands on a copy of this from all the different booksellers that are out there. But where can my listeners find you yourself on social media?
Yeah, you can get me on Facebook at Jim Park or James D. Park Jr. Author. I have two Facebook pages, and I would love to correspond with people and get to know people. I don't have a website because I just don't think I have the time and energy to manage one, and I'm just doing Facebook and emails. You can email me at jimdpark@yahoo.com, and I love to talk to people, and I spend most of my time every day writing and communicating.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's fantastic. And I am so grateful that you reached out to be a part of this show. I am so grateful that I got to hear so many of these amazing stories. I'm really fascinated by these, and I'm really looking forward to finding out more. And I hope that all of you who have been listening are feeling the same thing. This really is exactly what Jim's editor had said, that this is history at eye level. This is exactly that sort of perspective that is needed in all the different stories that are out there. Just like everyone had said that all the great stories have been told, Jim has proven several times already that's not the case, because there are your stories to be told. There are your perspectives to be shared. There's your history to be put out there, to be woven into all these other stories that are out there that are ready to be discovered, just like Jim's has, and just like I hope that all of yours has, because I've said this many times before, in these crazy times, we need your stories, your vision, your ideas now more than ever. So for Jim Park, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to he'sgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@he'sgotit.com.